Support comes from Mosby Building Arts, helping families love their homes again. Inspiration at callmosby.com.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Lethal injection is far and away the most common method states use to execute convicted criminals. On the surface, it appears more humane than electrocution, firing squad, or nitrogen gas. But a deeper look reveals how prominent error, ineptitude, and secrecy have been in the history of lethal injection, all of which has led to many botched executions and people suffering. University of Richmond law professor and death penalty scholar Corina Barrett Lane's debut book is titled Secrets of the Killing State, The Untold Story of Lethal Injection. It explores the secretive world of lethal injection in the United States and in Missouri. She joins us now to talk about it. Corina, welcome to the program.
Thanks. So nice to be here.
So Corina, before we start, I'd like to make it clear that this book doesn't come out of a university press. In other words, it's not an academic book, and that was very much on purpose. Why, Corina?
Well, actually, it's what we call a crossover book. So it did come out of a university press. It's published by New York University Press. So it has all of the academic backing of my research, but it's a crossover. And so you're exactly right. I wrote this for the public, and I wrote it for the public because I think everyone should know what the state is doing in their name.
How much of that relates to the way lethal injection kind of figures in popular imagination?
Well, I think there's this overwhelming sense in the popular imagination that lethal injection is just someone falling into forever sleep. And that's not what it is. In fact, that was my research question was, well, wait a minute. We know how to put down PETs. We know how physician-assisted suicide works. Why are states so bad at this? And in the process of researching that question, I found that lethal injection is absolutely nothing like what we think. It doesn't work at all in those ways.
What was your starting point, Corina? Was there something that you saw or read or heard about that got you started on this path of research?
Well, I remember an early execution. It was Oklahoma's botched execution of Clayton Lockett. That was the execution where Clayton Lockett woke up in the middle of his own execution. The execution was 47 minutes long, and he's talking and groaning, and people are gasping, and he's trying to get up off the gurney. And I remember thinking, you know, why am I seeing two-hour-long executions? Why am I seeing three-hour-long executions? Why am I seeing people waking up and trying to get off the gurney? Why am I seeing autopsies with 18 puncture wounds and autopsies with tan-colored makeup trying to cover those wounds? And so that's what really got me started.
And that was 11 years ago, right?
It was indeed. So I started researching lethal injection in earnest in 2017. I researched it for a year. I thought I was just writing an academic article. That's what we do. And by the end of the year, it became clear to me that this was a book. I actually didn't want to write a book, so I set it down shortly. And there's a whole face story behind how it came to be that I decided in January 2018 to write this book. But that is when I began writing it. And so it is now 7 years later. And this book, Secrets of the Killing State, is a product of 7 years of deep research into lethal injection and executions more largely nationwide.
Would you say, Corina, that there was a turning point in lethal injections becoming the primary means for state executions? I mean, that was not always the case, right?
Absolutely. Lethal injection was invented 1977. And this was one of the big surprises for me as a death penalty scholar. I thought there was science behind lethal injection. Surely someone didn't just make it up off the top of their head. But alas, someone did make it up off the top of his head. Lethal injection came in 1977 from the state of Oklahoma's medical examiner, Jay Chapman. He later described himself as an expert in dead bodies, but not in how to get them that way. Mm. And he came up with the three-drug protocol that every state used for the next 35 years. I found an interview that he had done where they said, how did you come up with these drugs? Because not a single one of them is the drug that we use to put down our beloved pets. And he said, I didn't do any research. I just thought about what might be useful. You wanted two drugs, so if one didn't kill the prisoner, the other did. And the researcher, the interviewer said, well, why did you add a third drug? And he said, why not? I didn't do any research. Why does it matter why I chose it?
Missouri, that was
1977.
Right. So Missouri and Oklahoma do have a connection that we are going to talk about a little bit later. But Missouri appears several times throughout your book. And one of the most striking stories involves another doctor. This is Alan Dorhoff. And this is a doctor who conducted 54 of Missouri's 65 executions between the years of 1976, that's shortly after introduction by Jay Chapman, and 2006. Who was Dr. Dorhoff, Karina?
He was Missouri's chief executioner from 1995 to 2006. He was known as Dr. Doe. And his identity being unveiled really tells us a lot. It's a nice example of what's going on nationwide. But lethal injection had been litigated in the Missouri courts, and a federal court had granted the state permission, had upheld the state's lethal injection protocol, which, among other things, required 5 grams of a drug called sodium thiopental. So the lawyers for the prisoners looked at the prior execution. The lawyer was representing someone, and he said, well, let's see. Let's make sure that Missouri is following the protocol, and looked at the prior drug, the chemical dispensary logs from that prior execution, and found that only 2.5 grams was being used. So the prisoner sues, and the state tells the court, well, you know, we were authorized to use 5 grams. We are using 5 grams. We would never violate the protocol. We're following the law and the judge's orders. We're trying to get to the bottom of why 2.5 grams would be used. The next day, the state of Missouri writes a letter to the judge and says, well, it turns out the chemical dispensary logs were correct. The amount that we have been injecting was wrong. We're trying to get to the bottom of why that is. The judge allows the prisoner's lawyer a limited deposition to find out, okay, why is this executioner using 2.5 grams? That's half of the amount of the all-important anesthetic. And here's what he said under oath in the deposition. He said, quote, I sometimes transpose numbers. I'm dyslexic, so it's not unusual for me to make mistakes. Now, he later said he was not dyslexic, he just sometimes transposed numbers. But this led to litigation in which the district court said, you know, that this doctor may not participate in lethal injection in any manner, at any level. And the court said that the court had learned that, you know, the process of mixing 3 different drugs, knowing the correct amount of drugs to dissolve in the correct amount of solution, involves precise measurement and the ability to use, decipher, and not confuse numbers. So then Missouri appeals. And in that process, investigative journalists, this was Jeremy Kohler in Missouri, fantastic investigative journalist, but he says, well, you know, who is this? You know, who could this person be? he finds out Alan Durhoff's identity. Durhoff admits it's him, and in fact says, no one will ever do as many executions as I have. And when he finds his identity, he finds that this doctor had been sued for medical malpractice over 20 times, had his hospital privileges revoked at 2 hospitals, had been publicly reprimanded by the state medical board. So very problematic.
Mm-hmm. So Dr. Durhoff then, I mean, after this debacle, the revelation of all of those malpractice suits, Missouri passes then its secrecy statute. Mm-hmm. What did this statute do, and is it still in place?
It is still in place, and it's quite telling that, as you say, in the wake of this scandal, what does the Missouri legislature do? It passes a statute that says it is unlawful for anyone to reveal the identity of a current or past executioner. And if they should violate this law, they are subject to punitive damages. So, you know, Missouri's response to the revelations of something that is absolutely indefensible. And by the way, you know, the Missouri Attorney General's office knew all of this when it was assuring the court of this Dr. Doe's professional competence.
Mm-hmm.
But their response was to say, you know, we're just going to make it so that there won't be any revelations in the future. We're going to make it unlawful
to
reveal this sort of information.
Right. And yet Dr. Durhoff went on to perform executions for other states and the federal government after he was barred from performing executions in Missouri. And he was also not the only executioner in the state or country who was unqualified for their job. What qualifies a person to be an executioner at a prison? And then, you know, a similar but related question, I mean, who actually does the job?
Very good. So you're right, Dr. Durhoff, within months of being disqualified and ruled by federal courts, you know, not to participate in executions, then was hired by the state of Arizona and conducted an execution for the state of Arizona, with Arizona knowing full well, you know, what the ruling was in the federal court in Missouri and the reasons behind it. That goes to your question of who decides who gets to be an executioner. And the answer is, the warden. It's the warden, and sometimes it's the Department of Corrections director, but generally it's the warden who is actually choosing the executioners. And it depends on the states, but there is no law, there is no rule saying, you know, what the minimal qualifications have to be. And so, you know, my sense from studying executions deeply across the country for seven years, is that the executioners are whoever the warden can get to say yes to being an executioner. And this leads to another very surprising find for me. I thought there were doctors actually doing the executions. And that's actually not true. Even in Durhoff's case, he said, well, I don't push the syringes. I'm not actually administering the deadly drugs. That's all done by the prison guards.
Mm.
And that's what I have found across the country. It's prison guards who are actually administering the drugs, and they're doing it from another room, from a separate room, through 7 feet of tubing.
Mm-hmm. This is a great spot for us to take a quick break, but we'll come back and continue this conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
Support comes from the St. Louis Public Library Foundation. During these challenging times, free access to digital resources is a necessity. You can help our community stay connected. Support your St. Louis Public Library at slpl.org.
Welcome back. Let's return to our conversation with Karina Barrett Lane. She's a scholar of the death penalty and a University of Richmond law professor. Her new book, Secrets of the Killing State, examines the history of lethal injection in the United States and includes several specific stories that have Missouri relevance. Before the break, Karina, you were talking about who does the administering of the lethal injections, but I'd like to hear from you about what is literally in those syringes and in that tubing, and about the providers of those drugs. Now, the drugs required for lethal injections started becoming less available at a certain time, and so states started using some, you know, creative methods to obtain pharmaceuticals, namely using compound or specialty pharmacies. And Missouri was a part of quite a bit of that compound pharmacy controversy. Tell us about this story and that Oklahoma connection, Karina.
You bet, Elaine. Well, on at least three occasions in 2013 and 2014, Missouri Department of Correction officials drove to Oklahoma with an envelope containing $11,000 in cash and returned with compounded pentobarbital for use in lethal injection. The store that it bought that from is called the Apothecary Shop. It wasn't licensed to dispense or distribute controlled substances in Missouri, and its interstate sale of controlled substances without a prescription violated state and federal laws. When that shop's identity was revealed, there was an investigation. The Board of Pharmacy conducted an inspection of the premises and found 1,892 regulatory violations.
How did this all come to light?
This was more investigative journalism and litigation. Between the two of those is where all of this came to light.
And here in Missouri, the Apothecary Shop was in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Here in Missouri, there was the Foundation Care Pharmacy. And both of those ended up being closed down due to malpractice. So where is it that Missouri is getting its drugs now?
Well, that is the $1 million question. It's hard to say where Missouri's getting its drugs because of the secrecy statute. And that's part of the problem, is that with a secrecy statute, you know, what we know from the suppliers we have found is that the very sort of drug supplier that is willing to exchange drugs for $11,000 in cash under the table without a prescription is just the sort of place one might think, but we just don't know.
And this under-the-table approach, and as I characterized it as creative methods, this is because pharmaceutical companies, they do not want to dispense these medications for execution purposes, right?
That's exactly right. Every single major pharmaceutical producer has actually not only stated that it will not sell drugs and written letters to the governors and to the departments of corrections, but they have now, each and every one of them, put contractual provisions on their sales saying, we will not sell to you for this purpose. And so you must sign a contract to actually purchase these drugs saying, I will not be using them for lethal injection. I will not sell them to someone else who would use them for lethal injection. And, you know, in part, this goes to corporate core values. They, you know, their mottos are to help people live longer lives. You know, wellness is our business. Life is our life's work. So that's potentially awkward to have their drugs being used to cause people to promptly die. But also they've suffered financial consequences when their drugs have been used in executions from being sued for botched executions or to having their being divested from investors.
In the book's epilogue, Karina, you focus on a story And that is the story of Brian Dorsey. He's a Missouri man who was executed in 2024, despite many prison staff and others advocating for his survival. And we actually talked about that case on this show. I'm going to leave the description of Dorsey's story to you, because I'd like to hear what about it left such an impression on you, you know, so much that you decided to share it in the epilogue of your book.
Oh, I'm sorry. Were you asking me?
Yes.
I thought you were going to. Oh,
yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Uh-huh. I wasn't sure if you needed a moment there.
Yes. Okay. So here's the thing. I was writing in that epilogue about something. It wasn't part of my research, but it was something I learned that I felt was very important to share with my readers. And it is that in the process of studying executions, I also had a front row seat to see who these people are at the end. You know, not who they were at the time of their crime, not who they were at the time of trial. Who are they 17, 20 years later? And they're not the same person. And, you know, I was writing about that when a Google News alert came across my desk, and it was an op-ed that was written by corrections officers about Brian Dorsey. And the title of it was, "We Corrections Officers Know Brian Dorsey Has Changed. Governor Parsons Don't Execute Him." And so I thought, well, I'm definitely going to read that. What do they have to say? And what they said was, he lived in the honor dorm of the prison, and he was the prison barber. And he cut the hair of not only all of the other prisoners, but by choice, the prison guards and the two wardens. And what they wrote really stuck with me. They said, Mr. Dorsey is an excellent barber and a kind and respectful man. There isn't a nicer guy than Brian. And they went on to say, taking Dorsey's life would be especially traumatizing for the many current and former prison staff members who have come to respect and care for this exemplary inmate.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote about it.
Karina, you do not state explicitly what your personal position is on the death penalty. And that said, you know, in our last minute and a half or so, why would you encourage someone who's in favor of capital punishment to read your book?
This book is about how we kill, not about whether we should kill. And I make that clear in the beginning. So if you support the death penalty, you should still read this book. But I think for the death penalty, often people say, well, they deserve it. And in my mind, that's just half of the equation. The other half of the equation is whether the state has done what it needs to do to deserve to take that life. And reading this book, it's not a book where I make an argument and try to convince you that I'm right. It's a book where I relentlessly document what states are doing in the people's name. And I think it would be hard to walk away from reading this book and feel that the state could be trusted with that awesome responsibility.
Mm-hmm. And quickly, do you feel like people are responding in the way that you'd hoped?
Oh, it's been this amazing, yes. It's been this amazing opportunity for people to have really important discussions. And the thing about executions is this is where the death penalty hits the road. You know, the rubber hits the road. It's not just an idea. Somebody has to actually kill somebody. That's what the death penalty is. And so these are very, in my mind, the most important of the conversations. And the lessons here also, you know, are applicable across a number of other contexts where people are dehumanized. Mm.
Karina Barrett-Lane is the death penalty scholar and author of the new book, Secrets of the Killing State, The Untold Story of Lethal Injection. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Elaine, for having me on. It was a pleasure.
This episode was produced by Olivia Mizell.
Audio engineering and sound design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.